You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
We're taping on Thursday, which is, you know, a dangerous day to tape in the Trump era because everything
that
drops.
Week we taped on a Thursday, and I don't even remember the stuff that happened, but a lot happened, like, before our video even went,
I think Syria. I think Syria started to happen after.
No, there was something else. There was another. Oh, it was the Kevin Williamson story.
Right. That's right.
I mean, Syria too, but the one that happened immediately after we hit like record or you know, after we stopped taping was Kevin Williamson, which would have been more fun to talk about than Syria. I mean, Syria is more important to be sure, but. In terms of what we do best here, which is just rank punditry and navel gazing, Kevin Williamson would have been right up. We could have. That's like a you know, dialogue like orgy of possibilities that we totally. And now it's too late. That's the thing. If we were to talk about Kevin Williamson now, it's ridiculously late.
So we totally missed it. That stuff has been pretty picked over at this point.
We totally missed it. So anyway,
and I don't know what's going to happen in the next 36 hours, but Wednesday, yeah. April 11th was probably the most insane news day, arguably of the entire Trump presidency to date.
What happened that day,
Bill? Well, you had the Paul Ryan announcement.
Yeah.
You had the stepped up campaign to. Go after Mueller and Rosenstein and Comey, capped off with the Sean Hannity barrage last night. You had the Minute Missouri Governor report drop about how he allegedly sexually assaulted his mistress.
Getting very, you know, relatively little coverage in compared to what it might have gotten in a different universe.
Right. You have John Boehner joining a marijuana company board. You have Mike Pompeo found having a Chinese business connection that he didn't disclose on his forms. Scott Pruitt, the news about how he was putting his name and everything and trying to get rid of the EPA logo because it looks like a marijuana leaf, which is insane. I'm sure I'm missing 10 other stories, you know? I didn't get to Syria.
Trump's tweet.
Right.
Trump's tweet about the smart weapons and all smart bombs and all that. No,
which you now is undercut this morning.
It's interesting, and yet one does get the sense that we're going to tape this, and then something else is going to happen. Another Kevin Williamson, and I think the only answer to this is we should be taping this show every day. I think that in 2018 demands a daily. DMZ.
It should be like a Truman Show. We should just be wired all the time. We just have body cameras on, and then you know we both hit like a secret button where it's like emergency podcast time, and we can go live on Google Hangouts immediately whenever necessary.
The things we joke about today will be a dystopian future very soon.
Well, let's start with Paul Ryan. I think Paul Ryan is obviously. Not just important as far as the immediate politics, but what it says about the state of conservatism. You know, there's a lot of Paul Ryan postmortems out there which say Paul Ryan failed in his vision. He didn't reform Medicare and Social Security. He said he wanted to balance the budget. The red ink has been rising on his watch. You know, the one thing you can say, the tax reform, it's something that was not coupled with any kind of spending cuts to prevent the deficits from skyrocketing. And through all this, he sat idly by while Donald Trump's nativist populism took over the party, which is very antithetical to Paul Ryan's, you know, Jack Kemp compassionate conservatism. Is there any of that you think is overwrought or unfair?
Oh, I think most of it's unfair. It's unfair for Paul Ryan to be blamed or to be like the face of this. Let's see. So where to begin? First, I think that We have weakened our institutions, including what it means to be the Speaker of the House. He doesn't have that much power to force people to do the things he wants them to do. He isn't Sam Rayburn. He doesn't have earmarks. So the idea that, like, Paul Ryan just sat by and let this happen, he could have stood, like, let's game out what happens if Paul Ryan plays his cards any differently. He was handed a very weak, you know, he was dealt a very weak hand, in my opinion. I'm not saying he's a hero. I'm just saying that, like, I'm much more sympathetic to his plight and to the difficulty of the task that he was handed. Yeah, I think certainly people could say, well, this proves that it's Donald Trump's party and that, yeah. Guess what? I've been saying that for two or three years. Yes, it does suck. Paul Ryan had to do what he had to do, partly because, for now at least, Donald Trump has the Republican base, and that impacts what sort of rank and file members of Congress want to do. I mean, it was hard anyway. Look at John Boehner and had the Freedom Caucus to contend with. It's a very difficult time to be a leader. On top of that, democracy is messy. We have a system that doesn't allow for people, even who have grand ideas and visions, to do much quickly. You put all that together, this is like not a great endorsement for Paul Ryan. If this isn't like he's the awesome, you know, awesomest speaker ever, but it is to say, like, I just think a lot of the criticism of him is actually just unfair. It's a little bit sad that you have a guy who I think had some creative ideas and vision, and his brand of conservatism in the long run would have been much more attractive and appealing to 21st century Americans. It's a sad story that his vision lost out to Trumpism. But the notion that he is somehow responsible for that, and that this is an indictment of him, I just don't think is accurate.
Well, to the extent that he deserves some responsibility is that he had successfully established himself as being the policy leader for the party. He got in Congress before he was 30 years old. He saw himself as a policy guy, and he worked very hard to position himself, you know, House Budget Committee chair, House Ways and Means chair. He tried to popularize his vision of Medicare and Social Security and you know, relatively austere budgets, to be charitable. He was unable, before Trump, he was unable to make that vision a popular vision that the public rallied around. And because he was identified as the, you know, intellectual heart of the party, the fact that intellectual heart didn't beat very strong was why Trump was able to come in and, like, knock over that house of cards and take over the party for himself. If he had, I mean, however you want to slice it, I mean, I won't choose the options here, but if he was either and or a better policymaker, a better legislator, a better salesman, a better politician.
Here's the problem with that, Bill. What Paul Ryan was trying to do is very difficult. For one thing, get people to be willing to raise the retirement age in order to make the social safety net sustainable. Now, I think that is a very noble crusade. It's also a thankless crusade. Okay? So Paul Ryan was going after, like, sort of third rail politics, asking people to eat their vegetables and their vitamins and not candy. Okay, that is a thankless job to tell people to do what they ought to do, not what they want to do. Donald Trump got to come in and tell people we're not touching, you know, we're not going to touch your Social Security or your Medicare or whatever. Just like Barack Obama came in and said, if you like your health insurance, you can keep your. They told people what they wanted to hear. Paul Ryan, I think, got burned by trying to do big things that were the right thing to do at the macro level for the country, but very bad politics. Now, he wasn't a good enough salesman to sell taking your medicine versus eating chocolate cake. I will grant you that.
Now, I don't want to get into a deep debate about the merits of the policy, but these are bars of success that he set for himself. He tried to do these big things. You could say, hey, he nobly failed to do these big things, but the bottom line is that he largely failed. The things that he tried to do not only did not work, but they were such big belly flops that the party's pendulum, the internal party pendulum, swung the other way. And look, this is a critique that I have made about the left sometimes. You know, people complain to me, why are you so down on single payer? You know, if you don't try, you can't win. Why do you have to be such a naysayer all the time? There's polls that show that people like this stuff. Why can't you just get behind it? And I try to tell people, you know, there sometimes when you go for that brass ring and right. you don't succeed, there are serious ramifications and consequences to that. And if, so what you just said, you're basically yeah. saying that Paul Ryan was articulating what we ought to do.
Yeah.
Now,
I just
want to have this was one point. And I would say the same thing in terms of single payers. I would say in terms of privatizing Social Security and Medicare. If you believe deep down that this was absolutely essential, anything short of this is doom for the nation, then it's logical to say, well, I really, as hard as this is, there's no choice but to try because it's certain failure if I don't try at all. But what if there were other things you could be doing that were pretty good, might actually help a lot of people, but were short of your idealized view? You know, maybe it's not as necessary as you think it is. If you took a breath and took a step back and said, you know what, if I chose option C, D, E, F, or G, I might actually move the ball forward and not have this enormous belly flop that's going to cause a big pendulum swing. I think Ryan... and maybe because he spent almost his entire adult life in the DC bubble, internalized this notion that, if you don't do these big entitlement reforms that, you know, all is lost. If he had a different perspective on his policy choices, he might not have set himself up to fail like that.
Yeah. I mean, a lot to digest there. One, I would say, although it's certainly true that the failure of conservative intellectuals to win the argument and implement policy helped open the door for Trump, I hardly think that was the primary, not only not the only, but not even the primary reason that Trumpism won. And so I think that Ryan is in many ways a victim of the times. This is a pro-Trump era. The Republican base wants to buy hatred and bitterness and fear. Paul Ryan has always been selling optimism and growth.
So which Reagan did very well.
Right.
And but Ryan has not.
Well, Reagan did it well. Partly because he was the great communicator. But I think partly because there's a zeitgeist. Like Churchill didn't, I'm not comparing Paul Ryan to Winston Churchill, but Churchill was Winston Churchill in 1933, but nobody was buying what he was selling. Nobody cared. He was out of touch with where the political moment was. He was a loser. He was in the wilderness. There are plenty of people who are right about the ideas and are charismatic, good salesmen, but at a certain moment, you can't sell what no one's buying. And I just think, I don't want to absolve Paul Ryan of, you know, mistakes and sins, and he's certainly not perfect. But I think that he has gotten swept up. There is a moment that is happening now. That is a moment of fear and of hoarding and of uncharitableness. And all of that cuts against Paul Ryan, who he is, and his vision. Now, what if Paul Ryan had gotten to become Speaker of the House if he was older? Let's say he had been born 10 years earlier or 15 years earlier. I mean, there's a scenario where he's the right man at the right place. What if Jeb Bush had been the nominee in 2000, right? Jeb Bush in 2016 was a joke, a complete joke, low energy Jeb. Wrong place, wrong time, right? It was a disaster. We could all admit that. Guy looked horrible. Jeb Bush in 1998 is a rock star.
Well, if right? Jeb Bush won the governor's race in Florida in 94 and George W. Yeah. Bush did not, you know, it's a whole different universe.
Yeah.
He would have had a much different sensibility as president in 2000 as George W. Bush did.
Now, does that mean that Jeb Bush in 1998 was smart and had good ideas, and Jeb Bush in 2016 is dumb and has bad ideas?
Well, that might have been bad all the way through.
or they might have been good all the way through.
But I think he would have been a much more he wouldn't have faced a Donald Trump juggernaut in 2000, assuming, of course, Donald Trump didn't stick with his Reform Party bid in 2000.
You get my point. Yeah. Now, my point, like, I think there's a fair argument that some of the reason Trumpism worked is because conservative intellectualism, conservative ideology failed, and that opened the door. But I think that's only a very, I don't want to say small, that's only a part of the story. Mm-hmm. I think that there are so many trends that have converged. Cyclical trends, technological trends, global trends, you know, all of these trends have converged to give us this moment that is particularly inhospitable to Paul Ryanism. I think he just tried to do the best he could for himself and for the country and for the party at this moment. And it was a lose-lose proposition. There was no way. All he was trying to do was to have the least worst outcome.
A smaller point I'd want to make is I think Paul Ryan was never a good legislator. He was not good at legislative tactics. You know, he's not someone who he came out of a think tank world. He was tutored by Jack Kemp. He always said he wanted to be policy making. He wanted to draft these policy ideas. He would craft the Better Way package and all that kind of stuff. But when he was House Budget Chair, he would draft these dreamy budgets that he could get through the House just based on the sheer force of the size of the Republican majority, but they wouldn't actually come into being. And he didn't want to be Speaker. He got roped into it, as we've all heard. But at least he thought this is a chance to try to drive some big policy ideas. And I don't know if you saw the most recent PBS Frontline episode, Trump's Takeover, but the first half of it covers the whole Obamacare repeal debacle. And they basically say, you know, Trump comes into the White House without a real strong policy agenda or policy interest. It's Paul Ryan that comes to the White House and says, we're doing Obamacare repeal first.
Yeah.
We can get this done by the spring. We can get tax reform done by the fall, and we'll do infrastructure after that. And granted, he salvaged tax reform from the abyss, but that was a bad legislative strategy. He clearly overestimated his ability to get Obamacare repeal done. It chewed up a lot of time on the clock.
No, I completely agree with you, Bill. I mean, and I know for a fact, I mean, that what you're saying is accurate. I mean, about in terms of healthcare, I know for a fact that you're right about that. And I'll concede that not everyone, I mean, it makes perfect sense that the guy who's kind of the visionary policy guy shouldn't be the guy, you know, doing the blocking and tackling or you know, strategizing of it. So I think that was clearly a deficiency. And the way to mitigate that, of course, is to recognize your weaknesses, to surround yourself with people who sort of complement, you know, who are strong where you're weak, and weak, maybe even weak where you're strong, to have a team of people who complement compliment you. I do think that his theory about health reform was clear about the strategy of passing it in hindsight was clearly wrong. However, I think there was a plausible, you know, they had a rationale for what they were trying to do in terms of like, we've been working on this for years and we're going to do it via reconciliation, but we have to do this. You know, remember, refresh my memory, but it was like, we have to do this first so that we can have the money saved to apply to that.
Which wasn't even correct. They did Ryan was still talking about having revenue neutral tax reform, which he abandoned. I mean, his plan to try to do
but
it in a way that wouldn't...
There was a rationale for why they did it.
Yeah, I mean, he had a rationale on paper.
Yeah.
And look, I can understand on paper saying, well, the base wants us to do this, and we have momentum, and we have the numbers, we can do it with 50, and, I really would love to, you know, get at Medicaid. There's my chance to get at Medicaid. Maybe get some Medicare reform in there. I think it was driven by an overestimation of the power of the base, and that obviously there's a lot of emotion in the base for Obamacare repeal, but without a clear-eyed look at the actual policy involved. And if he was a better policymaker, if he better understood health policy and the difficulties of health policy, he would have recognized, you know what, this, I mean you wrote about this at the time. This is a hornet's nest of policy.
But before I wrote about it, because when I wrote about it, I spent a couple weeks digging into it. But before I wrote about it, I did assume that Paul Ryan and Price and Ryan's and I'm trying to think of who else, you know, that, you know, you've got a doctor, you've got a policy wonk, you've got, you know, like, I overestimated their policy chops in terms of health reform. I was just listening to, because I listen to so many podcasts, I lose track of which ones I'm listening to, but I was listening to a podcast, and the upshot of it was that, you know, if you were to rank like the top 100 healthcare policy wonk sort of public intellectuals, how many of them would be on the center or center right? You know what I mean? Like 5 of them or something. You know what I mean? And so this is like an endemic problem.
I think this does rest on Paul Ryan. He sold himself and was pumped up in the media as the premier conservative intellectual. And for all of his pleasantness, and I'll even give him the benefit of the doubt that he actually has some sincere belief and actually wants to do right by people. I know there's plenty of people who might challenge even giving him that much benefit of the doubt, but let's give him that much. I don't think he's that good an intellectual. He wasn't strong enough himself to fully understand the policies that he was pushing and how complicated they were, nor did he build up an intellectual bench. He certainly could have, if he was concerned about trying to get policy done, you want to have an army of policy wonks at the ready. And he kind of hogged that spotlight at the expense perhaps of grooming other people who actually might be stronger on policy.
I just think you're being too hard on him. I really do. I mean, so first of all, there were policy problems, but there were all political considerations that went into making a bad bill that you had to do this because McConnell says he needs that, or the, you know, pharmaceuticals say they need this, or they're going to run ads tacking. I mean, there's so many variables, right? It's really hard to do things. I mean, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton are smart people.
They got hammered. They got hammered on it.
Right. They got hammered. But it doesn't mean that they're not smart. It doesn't mean that they're overrated as, you know, intellectuals. Look, I just think Paul Ryan is one dude, and there are 435 members of Congress. And, like, I feel like there's a sense that like all there, that we want to like he's going to bear all of our burdens, you know, like take all of our sins, all of our sickness and disease and sins, and bear all of our burdens. That there's now a sense that like all the problems of the conservatism should be borne by Paul Ryan. Like if he should have been out there not only being a dad to three or four kids and doing his hillbilly hand fishing in Wisconsin and running for vice president and voting, you know, being actually a member of Congress, flying back and forth to, you know, like, but he should have also been building a generation of conservative intellectual leaders. And he should have been like, look, he's not like, I'm not saying he needs to, like, he does not belong on the Mount Rushmore of conservative leaders, right? This is not a great moment for him. Like, this is not, like, he's not coming off of this looking like a hero. But I also think that the amount of criticism and responsibility that he's taking is unfair. I really do.
Let's shift to cruder political considerations. What does this mean for the midterms? And is Paul Ryan helping or hurting? I mean, Republicans are already obviously, you know, back on their heels in terms of the midterms. Is this going to, is it going to help matters to kind of, you know, clarify the situation and let them essentially, I mean, they talk about, I mean, not having a new leader established after the election, but that might change. Giving someone who's a fresh face in Wisconsin one get in there and, or is this just
Paul Nealon? Is it Paul Nealon? Is that the guy's name?
Paul Nealon's the anti-Semite who was in the primary. So obviously that? Someone's going to get
he's
in that
only
race.
Another Republican running as of now,
right?
But that'll probably change.
I'm also the digression. You know, everyone's sort of assuming that Randy Bryce, you know, aka Iron Stash, is a lock in the Democratic primary. One, he has an opponent, Kathy Myers, who has won school board elections in Janesville, whereas Bryce has not won elections before. So I wouldn't even assume he could win a primary against her. We don't really have a lot of data yet on that. You know, obviously, although Bryce has got a national media and tons more money because of the viral videos. But if you're a budding Democrat in that district, why would you assume that Bryce, who has certain degrees of baggage, has said some things that are controversial, has not won elections in the past, you know, why wouldn't you jump in and say, I can win a three-way race against these two? Or more than one. That primary is not till August. So there's time for another Democrat to jump in there. So I think that's very potentially.
And that
very
seat
fluid.
Is up for grabs. And that seat could go Democrat.
Yeah, I mean it leans right. I mean it's Obama won it in 2008, Romney won it in 2012, and Trump won it by 11 points in 2016. But because Obama won it once, some people say, well, it's not that Republican a district, which is true, but this most recent Supreme Court election that happened in Wisconsin, the conservative candidate won that district pretty handily. So I would still think this is a leans right district. But clearly, if you're a aspiring Democrat in that area, open seat, this is your one shot. I wouldn't think you necessarily would back off, in deference of Bryce. But be that as it may, is this going to help Republicans? Is it a non-factor because they're already in trouble, or is it going to actively make things worse? More retirements, less fundraising, deeper sense of doom. I mean, there already was an article in the Washington Post a couple days prior where donors were saying the House is already lost. Let's just work on saving the Senate because there's no way we're going to win the House. I mean, where do you think this impacts things?
If you're a Republican, it's time to turn the hat on backwards, put on some Rage Against the Machine, start doing curls, baby. No, it's bad. It's bad. Look, Republicans, I thought they were already going to lose the House. I think this expedites, if anybody's on the fence about retirement, now the captain of the ship is abandoning ship, you know.
Should he have waited?
I think, I'm open to debate on this, and I think I'm sure there's an argument that what he did is fine. My instinct is he should have waited. He should have run for re-election, acted as if everything was fine, and gone down with the ship. And then, you know, then as soon as, the, you know, as soon as it's over, you bow out. That's what I think he probably should have done. But that just strikes me as the right thing to do. But
I mean, he seems to think there was some sort of unfair to his own constituents to run for a race that he knew he wasn't going to finish out the term for. But he wouldn't be the first guy to step down from a speakership after an election and have a special election. Like, there's worse things in the world than having a special election.
Right. You could be like, look, I mean, I was committed to running, but this failure means that the Republican Party needs new leadership. It's time for me to go. And I think that, you know,
I'll tell you the one thing where I think it's going to help matters for Republicans, relatively speaking. Assuming he sticks with his pledge to remain Speaker through November, we still have to keep the government open on September 30th, which is 4 weeks before Election Day. And Ryan can now behave like a John Boehner in 2015 right. and say, look, we're keeping the government open. Screw you, Freedom Caucus. I'm not under your thumb. If I need Democratic votes for this, I'm getting them. And we're not going to have some giant debacle before Election Day, barring the mental stability of our president.
Unchained.
I mean, why would you want to be Speaker now? Why would you want to start your speakership? There is nothing on the agenda. There's absolutely nothing to get past that has any chance of happening. The only job you have is to keep the government open, and that's a pain in the ass of a job. So let Ryan deal with that stuff.
And he never wanted to be Speaker anyway. Right. But yeah, I don't know why anybody would ever want to be anymore, especially in this environment.
I went and checked the average length of a Speaker's tenure. It's pretty short. Almost everybody is under 5 years, and obviously there's different reasons for that.
Right.
But it's not a it's I mean, and there are certain examples. You know, I mean Denny Hastert, the illustrious Denny Hastert. You know, he had 8 years, and you know Tip O'Neill had 10. I think there was one guy that had 17. But it's you know, usually you get at end of your career and you leave on your own terms, or the house flips, or you get felled by a scandal or whatnot. I mean, you know, the knives are out for you, man, when you're in the speaker's chair. So it's not like it's a real career. It's not a recipe for career longevity.
Yeah, it's like cover of the Sports Illustrated magazine. Yeah. So anyway, you know, Paul Ryan, we hardly knew ye. I have floated this idea that other people have now co-opted. Although, in fairness, someone told – this is just like when I predicted that John Boehner would possibly leave his speakership after Pope Francis came. It's hard for me to take credit for something that someone else gave me the idea for. But I, a month or so ago, right after the day it was announced that that Arthur Brooks would be stepping down as head of the American Enterprise Institute, I tweeted that maybe Paul Ryan should be the next head of AEI. And now apparently other people are joining in on that. We'll see what happens.
That would make a certain amount of sense. Now, he says he's going back to Janesville to be with his kids.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of reporting. You know, Tim Alberta has a great send-off to Ryan in Politico, where he says that's on the level. He's aware, his dad died early, his grandfather died early, but I don't obviously can't know what his day to day home life is going to be like. But his kids are teenagers. Well, I don't have teenagers yet. My understanding is that teenagers aren't around the house all that much. they go off to college after that.
I'm looking forward to Bill Scher with two teenage daughters.
Yeah, me too.
Cleaning his shotgun as suitors come calling.
And maybe he wants to live the Wisconsin life and be able to just write his op-eds and go hang out in the woods.
But I
would not be surprised if he's home for a couple months and be like, wait a second, my kids aren't actually around. I don't really need to be here.
I mean, I think, you know, there have been in the past, like, I think, like when Pat Toomey or Chris Ciccolo were head of Club for Growth, I think they mainly lived in like Pennsylvania and Indiana respectively, and they come in for a week and then they're gone for two weeks.
Maybe that's what he does. You do AEI from Wisconsin.
What's his name? Family Research Council guy.
Tony Perkins. He's in Louisiana, right?
I think he technically is mostly in Louisiana, you know. So maybe you can have your cake and eat it too, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's change topic. And it might be dangerous to get into it because it is Thursday. Who knows what happens Friday?
I hear Kevin Williamson has just been re-fired by National. It's Williamson watch, baby.
I'm just waiting for the book deal.
That's a good idea.
I mean, he's got to get a book deal out of this.
Yeah.
Anyway,
you should be pitching this.
I'm not an agent.
Yet.
If you're Donald Trump, should you fire Mueller? Should you fire Rosenstein? Is it worth the heat you're going to get? Is it worth the risk of impeachment? Or would you feel like, you know what? The base has my back. Republicans are too scared of me. I can whack these guys and get away with it.
Well, I mean, it depends. It's like asking, should Nixon have burned the tapes? In hindsight, yes, he should have. My guess is that Donald Trump isn't actually guilty of colluding with Russia. Now, I think if you dig around enough in his financials, you're going to find some interesting stuff. My gut is that the smart move is not to fire them. In fact, you could certainly argue that this attempt to, we'll call it obstruct justice light, mm-hmm. got him in trouble. Like firing James Comey, you know, led to where we are today. So my instinct, knowing sort of based on what I think I know, is that it would be a mistake to try to do this. You know,
I mean,
he just quit acting so damn guilty.
I mean, I generally agree. And I have assumed, well, one, I wrote a piece last year in Real Clear Politics, which was why Trump can get away with firing Mueller. And I do think he would get away with it. I do not think he would get impeached for firing Mueller and Rosenstein. I mean, maybe Democrats would impeach him if they took over the House, but I don't think he'd get convicted in the Senate. But that was over a year ago, and he has not done that. And I think it's a very interesting question. Why is that the case? And there's two plausible scenarios. And one, based on reporting, is that he really wants to. He has threatened to do it in private at least twice from what we read in the papers. But the people of Bradman said, hey, buddy, that's crazy talk. You don't want to get impeached here. Don't do that. And so he's being essentially restrained from what he really wants to do by his team. And he's getting more and more unrestrained as we go along. So that's possible. The other possibility is that he knows deep down that there's a risk of impeachment there, and it's not worth taking that risk. He might blow off some steam from time to time, but it's better to undermine and discredit Mueller and Rosenstein so whatever they produce is looked through a partisan filter, ensuring that it doesn't metastasize and become something that's impeachable and convictable.
That's probably a pretty good compromise. And I saw that you tweeted a New York Times article about the how Bill Clinton, you know, went after Ken Starr.
Well, one of the folks at Politico, I assume is younger than me, had tweeted out saying, "And they would older than me. Remember, if Clinton, you know, went at Ken Starr in the same way, noting that in the same way as Comey."
Yeah, because there's the RNC has the Lion James Comey website.
Right. Noting that Starr is not a private citizen the way Comey is right now. So he said, but does anyone know what happened? And I dug out that New York Times piece. There was a piece saying, what a great job Clinton is doing shredding Ken Starr. And they have James Carville on the record saying this is a war. Right. And there's total transparency about how they are humiliating him and destroying him. And Bill Clinton's approval rating is shot to 73%. And Republicans are saying Ken Starr is overreaching. It was just a complete evisceration of Ken Starr.
And when conservatives talk about double standards and bias, that's one of the that's like exhibit A, right?
And so you could definitely make that point just based on that information. Now you could also say, let's remember some of the other history here. Kenstar was the second independent counsel, not the first. The first one was apparently on the verge of exonerating Clinton, and the three-judge conservative panel swapped him out to ensure that Clinton would be further put through the ringer. They jumped from Whitewater into Monica Lewinsky, which was considered as arguably, you know, going beyond the purview of the investigation. They just raided
the Donald Trump's lawyer's office, which I guess speculation is that it's the what they're looking for is outside the scope of.
But Mueller said, this is outside my scope.
Okay.
I'm going to hand it off to somebody else and they can make the decision what to do with it. Although obviously Republicans who are loyal to Trump are saying that Mueller's already gone beyond getting into obstruction of justice and financial dealings and whatnot. So, yeah, we only know so much from leaks to be able to adjudicate that, but obviously those debates exist. It's certainly not unusual for a president to be mean to the prosecutor looking into their stuff. That is pretty standard. From there, you can say, okay, who does someone have the merits of the case to have gone into that? Or you could also say, whoever the merits of the case, that's really unseemly. You should just let the prosecutor do their job and defend yourself in the court of public opinion, court of the Senate, well, court of courts, but don't interfere with the process of the investigation. Obviously, Clinton didn't do that and came out looking great at the end of the day. Got acquitted, approval ratings were high, maybe had some fallout for Al Gore, but didn't hurt Clinton himself. Now, this is also second term against the backdrop of a booming economy. So there was definitely a wide public sentiment of, why are you doing this, Republicans? Why are you doing this, Ken Starr? This guy had an affair, but otherwise things are going fine. Leave the guy alone. Now, the economy is relatively good right now, but this is first term, a guy with unusually low popularity going into the job, which has only dropped further since, doesn't get that same benefit of the doubt from nearly anybody outside of his own base.
Well, therefore, and I think the Me Too moment has changed our perception about things, too. Even in the case of Monica Lewinsky, who now says that I think she questions whether or not it was consensual. Do you know what I'm saying?
I haven't heard that. She's talking about being bullied by and being demeaned by both Clinton's team and Ken Starr's team and by the media in general.
But I think what Monica is getting at is that when a man is the president and you are an intern,
yes,
you can't give consent.
I haven't heard her say that pointedly. I mean, I certainly understand the argument and I have sympathy to the argument.
I don't know if you're woke enough to get the point I'm making.
No, I have always held that was inherently an appropriate relationship because of the power dynamic. I'm just not aware of Lewinsky putting it in exact those terms, but perhaps she has it. I just haven't read it.
And it could be I'm sleep deprived. It could be that someone else recently made that on her behalf. But anyway, my point is that I think it was easier to sort of laugh off. Oh, it's just a BJ. The economy's great. You know, like part of the reason that would play different today is because the economy's not great, and because Donald Trump's approval ratings are not great. But part of it, I think, also is because our values have shifted in terms of that power dynamic.
Right, right. So by the end of the day, you would, if you were Trump, you would not fire. You would twist in the wind and not fire.
If I'm Trump, I would not twist in the wind. I would engage in what I'm calling, what you have advised, I would engage in the attempt to discredit and demean.
Well, that's about twisting the wind. You're letting Mueller and Rosenstein twist in the wind.
Oh, let them twist in the wind. Yeah. Yes. That's what I would do. That's what I would advise. Yeah.
All right. I know there's like 10,000 other things to talk
about. I would advise the most Yeah, I would basically do what the horrible. I would. So this is why I'm not a political advisor or a politician, but I think I would advise them to do that very dark and dirty thing, which is to attack the attacker and try to go after Robert Mueller's integrity and credibility.
Let me ask you one more question before we wrap up. If Trump doesn't do that, if Trump does fire Rosenstein and or Mueller, you know, in relation to that, you have to assume that the cries of impeachment will be louder at minimum amongst Democrats. Does that help or hurt Republicans in the midterms? I mean, Republicans in theory, I mean, right now, Republicans are more eager to talk about impeachment than the Democrats are, because they want something to whip up the base. They want to get them off their backs.
Right. Like
if you sit at home and the Democrats take the House, you know your boy Trump's getting impeached. We can't let that happen. Would Democrats be walking into a trap if Trump did that as bait? Or are there enough Republicans who are openly saying that is a bridge too far, that you wouldn't get the benefit of the backlash?
I think on the margins it would help Republicans. Mm-hmm. But we're not on the margins. This mm-hmm. is a wave coming. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that there's not. So, of course, there's an external political event that could change the trajectory of this election. But it's like it would have to be a huge, huge event in the political universe to shift this coming wave, right? And so, yeah, I think the notion that Democrats want to win the midterms so they can impeach Donald Trump probably has a net favorable benefit to Republicans. I just think it's like peeing in the ocean compared to, the wave. A lot of water references here. But anyway, I don't think it's enough.
All right. Anything else you want to talk about before we go?
No, I think we should shamelessly plug what we're doing and self-promote.
My new podcast, New Books and Politics, on the New Books Network, newbooksnetwork.com. My interview with Amanda Marcotte for her new book, Troll Nation,
yes.
Should be up by the I interviewed her yesterday. I believe that'll be up tomorrow. And I got some good names coming up for towards the end of the month, but I'm going to hold them in reserve for now. And just wait and see who's coming down the pike.
I interviewed Sheila Tate, who was press secretary to Nancy Reagan. Her book's called Lady in Red. I interviewed her on my podcast, Matt Lewis and the News. And we really got into kind of the unfair perceptions about Nancy. Well, in some cases, not unfair, but the perceptions about Nancy Reagan versus who she really was. And of course, we talked about, for example, the assassination attempt on her husband and the astrology. So you got to check that out. Also, sign up. I have my newsletter, Matt Lewis and the Newsletter, where I'm sending out a weekly little email. It's free. And it basically does two things. One, it's what I'm saying and writing, and it's also what I'm reading and listening to. So, like, if I hear a cool podcast, like I just listened to one with Mark Maron and Bill Simmons. That's pretty cool. So, like, that's the kind of thing I might write up, like, hey, check this out. Or movies. I saw this movie, this documentary the other day, The China Hustle. Have you seen this?
I have not.
Pretty wild, man. It's a documentary, and Wes Clark does an interview that he should not have done in this. and actually, Wes Clark like tries to like take off his mic and like leave in the middle of this like documentary. So anyway, go to mattklewis.com. In the upper right-hand corner, you can sign up for my email list, Matt Lewis and the Newsletter.
All right.
Another
jam-packed week of the DMZ, and we'll catch you next week.
All right, and whatever we said today, something crazy will happen as soon as we hit publish. So
that's the way of the world these days.
See you guys.
All right.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.